Good evening, good morning, whatever time it is.
Let's not fool anybody. It's not morning for us. It might be morning where you are, but where we are, it's evening.
It's evening. Welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast. We've had an entire month off, and we didn't say that we weren't going to do that, but we definitely didn't promise to podcast either, so no harm, no foul.
We're back. So we will be podcasting every single week.
Day, an hour.
We have lots of podcasts we do, or at least I do. I have
You do a bunch
the
of
Stand Firm
podcasts.
podcast, this podcast, and then there's this Cranmer Fellows podcast that John has started, which is good.
That a
So
regular gig for you?
I'm saturating the market with my voice. Is it there?
It's
I
important that people hear
hear
your
my
voice.
voice, right?
Also, we're trying out a little microphone here that we're holding up to ourselves.
Yeah, these are Bluetooth microphones, and it's not as fancy as the microphone that we have been using because Anne broke the microphone we have been
I
using
didn't break
by
it. I think
mispacking it.
you broke
We
it.
were intending to bring it down to South Carolina with us, where we went for vacation to use on our podcast down there, but apparently Anne broke it, so.
I literally didn't break it. So we bought something really cheap online, and I guess the listener will let us know how it's going. And we're also, as part of our constant path towards self-improvement and efficiency, a life of efficiency, trying to podcast at a different time.
Right. Monday morning has never worked for us.
It does work. We've done it for years.
But it has never worked
I
for
mean,
us.
technically,
Because
it literally
well,
works.
it hasn't worked for us because it destroyed our day. Like we spent all Monday
Trying to podcast.
we'd podcast for like an hour, and then we'd like try to put the recording up for another hour, and then we'd go for a walk, and then we'd work out, and then it'd be like noon. And so our day off would be ruined.
Or whatever day it is, because
Yeah.
I
Well,
think
we actually stopped taking our day off because of
the podcast.
Right. And so we might as well
So
work that day since it's not really a day off.
we have to figure out when to do it. This is important for us to have hash out on
Yeah,
with our listener. If anybody has any ideas about when we can podcast, please, please leave a comment or send an email. So how has your month been?
Are you asking me or
Yeah,
the
you.
listener?
Have you enjoyed your time off?
I mean, it's been good. We had a good time down in South Carolina. Everyone knows I don't like the beach. It's sandy, it's salty. I mean, there's water, a lot of water, but you can't drink any of it, and it's hot. There's no shade.
I just don't know why you would want to drink the water at the beach.
Well, I
Like,
mean, just like, okay, well, I know, but like,
you
it's like,
keep saying that like it's
I
next to
well, I mean, okay,
Disney.
you're surrounded by sand and heat, which says desert, and then body of water says life, but no, it's a saltwater body, so there's no life. It's just like you're surrounded by death and desolation.
Except
And
it was teeming with life because there were little baby crabs that we watched. There were those little things that bury themselves in the sand.
no, I know, but like
That was really
not
cool.
human life. Human
There,
humans cannot survive.
no, there were lots and lots of humans. They bring coolers.
Right.
There's like these big things that you can pull along the sand that have big wheels.
A shady forest with a
And
nice running stream would be much nicer. Like, why would you want
I
to
don't
sit in
know.
a
There were
hot
lots and lots of
sand
people at the
with
beach
the
having a good
sun burning
time.
down your skin? So anyway, you guys did that every day, and I read books and stayed at home or at the house we were staying in, which is a very nice place, and we were very happy, and it was good. But, I've realized I don't. It's very rare that I have a vacation that I actually relax totally. And you don't, you didn't relax either, did you?
No, I wrote some stuff and wrote some stuff and schlepped the kids to the beach and
Because there's always projects. You're always writing something, or you're like you have assignments to write things for CRI or other places, and you had several assignments. When we left for vacation, you had like several assignments hanging over your head that you had to get done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I finished one. I reviewed Kevin DeYoung's wonderful little book called Impossible Christianity, and I recommend it wholeheartedly and unreservedly. It was great. Oh, look, here comes the dog. Here he comes, creeping out.
He's pushed his way outside the door. We lock.
Nope, I guess he's...
I'm going to close the door on him. He's...
And then, but the main thing that you should know is that I got all the way through Women and the Gender of God. And I already did a Amy Peeler. I said on my short podcast for Demotivations that the name Amy Peeler makes me think of Amy Poehler. And I love Parks and Recreation. So I basically thought of, and Amy Peeler reads the book herself. So in my head, I pretended that Leslie Knope from Parks and Recreation was reading the book. And it really improved my overall experience. So I recommend that if you decide to get it on Audible, that you pretend that Leslie Knope from Parks and Recreation is reading Women and the Gender of God, and it improves it like 1,000%.
So this book is like the whole point of this thing is like it. She's under the impression that for centuries, I guess, Christians have believed that God is a male.
Well, and at the end of the book, right, she says that at her son's 8-year-old birthday party, she asked, or she heard one of the little boys saying to another little boy, "God is a man." And she was horrified that an 8-year-old little boy would think that God was a man. And
well, that of course, an 8-year-old boy was going
to say that. This is the genesis of this book. So incidentally, when I got to the end of the book, I asked my 19-year-old son, is God a man or a woman? And my child said, "Oh, obviously he's a woman. Why else would he be so caring?" And then he rolled his eyes and walked away.
He was kidding.
Yeah, he was kidding. But I thought it was a pretty great comeback.
I mean, but it seems like I have not read the book, but from what you have said, well, I've not read the book. I've read parts, swaths of it.
I've read parts of it too, even though you didn't want me to.
Yeah. So you've read the whole thing by now. So
yeah.
But it seems to me that she's belaboring a point or belaboring against a point or against an argument that no one really is making. Like no one's saying that God is a male, except in the sense of his incarnation in the person of Christ as a human man. He's a male, yes. But in his essence, as ontological essence as God, he's not male or female. He's not a physical being.
He has not a body like
yes.
men. is in the catechism.
So, but he does identify as he, him, right?
His
pronouns are he, him. And so he seems to indicate throughout the entirety of scripture that we should approach him as father and speak to him in masculine terms. Is she okay with that? Is she upset with that?
She makes a case for why you should accept what the Bible says about God.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's amazing, actually. NGL, like, she begins her, I said this on my short podcast, her premise is that women have been so oppressed and abused by the idea, the wrong idea, the blasphemous idea that God is male, that Christianity really needs to be rescued from that idea. And so that's her task, is to rescue the Christian God from this blasphemous idea that God would be male.
Wow.
And at the end, she explains that she's done a pretty good job. She says, "I've done this wonderful thing for Christianity."
And well, she know that, like, that that's not
actually yeah, what... no, I thought, like, well, that's really funny because everybody that I know and all the people I hang out with don't say that God, they don't think that God is a bearded old man in the sky. Like,
and you, but you know, but I guess what, like, maybe what she's trying to reach toward is you've explained this experience to me before, right? Like, at some point in your Christian life, you came to the realization that God doesn't know you as a man knows you, but as a woman knows you, not because he's a woman.
Well, no, not even as a woman. Like,
he knows you.
You have to go even farther than that. It's not even as a woman knows you, because other human women don't know.
Right.
I mean, it's more knowledge, like the way that women know each other is with more knowledge about the experience of being female than men have. That, incidentally, just to interrupt everything, that's why the trans thing is so, speaking of blasphemous, disrespectful, because a man imagining what he thinks it's like to be a female and then LARPing that is wicked and terrible. And that's not how God interacts with the human race. I just wanted to throw that out
there. No, so, right. So, but he knows, because he's our maker and he knit us together in our mother's womb and he made our emotions and he made our souls and he made our hearts and our minds. He's not like, when even though we call him father, because he calls himself father and we use masculine pronouns, he's not dealing with his female creatures as a human father would. Right.
Like, okay. I mean, I've seen a lot of fathers looking at their little daughters with complete bafflement.
Right. I mean,
every male father looking at a female daughter and the look in his eye is, I don't even know what's going on right now.
I mean, I don't know.
I, as a mother, also don't know what's going on with my daughters. That's why I'm saying, like,
I mean, all the times they've cried this last month. I mean, and I have no idea what the heck is.
I know more about that than I do, sort of, but not really.
You can kind of figure it out. I mean, I have no idea.
I'm in the dark as well. But that's not how God knows our daughters. He knows them intimately. And if he wanted to share his information.
I feel sorry for God having to know us. Like, how sad, how hard it must be to be God. I mean, I know it's not hard because it's infinite. I mean, okay, I'm not speaking theologically here. Like, I'm not speaking theologically here because I know God is like, there's nothing, he's inexhaustible. It's all the superlatives that belong to the English language apply to God. So I know he's not tired, but I just, if you had to know the depths of every human soul,
it would be really, really depressing.
It would be so dark.
It's like really what I hear when Jesus says, my father is working and I'm working. That's what I hear. It's like,
it's astounding. He, and knowing all of that, he still doesn't just say, okay, I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm done.
I don't care what you do. Switch rooms if you want. Nobody even cares. I'm going to bed. That's what I said.
Right. So that, I mean, just every time I think about that, that brings new depth to his mercy is everlasting and his patience is, he's long suffering. He's long, long suffering. He suffers long.
He's a good father. It's who he is. One of the appendix is called a good father. There's a lot of delights in this book.
So what was problematic about the book? Did you say anything that was
good? Well, okay, so her starting point is problematic. I don't think that Christianity has been oppressive to women. And the idea of God as father didn't need to be rescued
but
either.
What about John Wayne?
Yeah. Well, that's part one. Part two of problems with this is that she has to rescue, again, the incarnational narrative, the narrative of the incarnation from the idea of abuse that God, by making Mary be his mother, did he give her the opportunity to fully consent? So the
whole
incarnation,
that's not a question that any first century person would be asking.
No, but she has to, there's a lot, she has to build, one of her whole building blocks is modern day consent. And that's...
Can I let Gloria out?
No, not Gloria, because we're doing a podcast.
We don't want the cat or the dog. She builds the whole case on top of consent-based morality.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about that is that already that's cracking. Everybody is already discovering that consent-based morality is a worthless foundation upon which to build a civilization, much less a theology but she spends an awful lot of time on it. And I wish she had read Feminism Against Progress before she wrote this book, because I think she maybe could, like, I wish all these people writing these kinds of books would read a little bit of stuff that's a little more up to date, because I feel like they're all dated and they're coming out this year, but they're already too old. So that was another big problem.
I mean, I always felt like when I was reading, when we were in seminary, I always felt like some of the things our professors were saying were like liberal scholarship from 10 years beforehand. Like,
yeah.
Like things I'd read.
Yeah, I read about in the 90s and we got
right.
There, and like, or like the early
ooh,
90s.
And, hey. Ooh. Have you guys heard about the Jesus seminar?
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. About it. Super old.
Yeah, right.
Okay, boomer.
Right.
So consent-based morality, it's an absurd question to bring to the incarnation, because first of all, Mary could not possibly have fully consented in the way that we would require as modern day people, because she didn't know like what was going to happen. Like, if you knew that you were going to have Jesus and that he was going to die on the cross, you might say no thanks. So she had to say yes to God, not knowing what it was that she was saying yes to. So, and she built a big case for how she actually does kind of know, but it's not satisfactory. So that was another, I thought, these aren't problems that the Bible needs salvation from.
Did she get into the question of Jesus's DNA? Like, here's what, I think Denny Burke brought this up. It was like,
maybe she does. Yeah. All of his DNA came from his mother.
Right. So that means he's not really a male.
Well, his masculinity is apparently unlike any other man's masculinity.
Okay.
There's in fact almost nothing at all in Jesus' masculinity that you could recognize with regular.
So he hasn't saved us.
No, Mary, so like literally Mary was our savior.
Well, what I mean is, like, he saved women, because apparently
his
masculinity
is...
Well,
he does save men because he is a man.
But wait, I thought you said none of
his masculinity
isn't
the same as yours. Meaning he's not toxic, I'm pretty sure that's what that means.
Okay.
It's pretty vague.
I
did he bring up the...
My understanding, I read this part, and I read part of the, I read this, I think I read this part of the book, that her understanding of the incarnation is that it's because his humanity comes wholly from Mary, that he's, and he's male, even so, that he is able to transcend gender, that he's got some kind of... Because of that's the function that allows me to transcend gender. And Diddy Burke's point, if I'm remembering it correctly, is no. I mean, it's because he's the God man. it's his human nature that is whether he's male or female. That's not even a question. I mean, it matters in the sense that we think about him as king and husband to the church. But it doesn't matter in the sense of his soteriological work. Like he saves man and women equally as a human being, right? Is that?
Well, she did. That's what she should have said.
Right.
But that's not really what she says. That's not what she says.
Right.
She makes a really big deal about the gender question. Like she could have relied heavily on just the fact that he's human, but she tries to work out this weird genderedness between Mary's genderedness and Jesus and God the Father that makes it in each case emphasized in such a way that it throws the whole thing off kilter. It's just really odd. But I think the reason that she does that is because she's not so much interested in soteriology, even though she says she is, but really she's making a case for women's ordination. And that's really the point of the book, is that Mary basically functioned as prophet, priest, and king prophet, priest, and queen.
I thought the only person who did that was Jesus.
Well, yes, but also his mother. And so the Jesus fact that she, Mary. There's like three places where she functions. She, her work in salvation is so essential. It's like more essential than what Jesus did and what the Father did. And she just, it's so out of balance in terms of emphasis.
So it sounds like also, like I think you were telling me earlier, there's a kind of a non sequitur there. That because she bore Jesus' body in her womb, she should be a priest. Or I mean, women should be priests.
Amy Peeler should be allowed to celebrate the Eucharist.
And she's an Episcopalian priest, so yeah. I think that does.
But I don't really follow the line between Mary being the tabernacle.
No. Muriel, bring them all back in, please. We can't have a cat or the dog yet. Out. Okay.
The what was I saying? Where all the animals joined us. I've lost the thread.
Non sequitur of God was born of a woman in the person of Jesus, and so therefore all women should be able to be ordained.
Well, that's what I was saying.
That's the non sequitur, right?
I don't see the thread that Mary, Mary is the tabernacle of God's presence. Therefore, ergo, Amy Peeler gets to celebrate the Eucharist.
Right.
That's the conclusion that she draws, and it's really meaningful for her to be able to do that. And I don't really want to litigate the women's ordination question, as per usual. That's not interesting to me. What's interesting is the logic there, and here's another point where she's arguing against something that nobody has said. Even the most conservative person in the world would never say that women are not allowed to talk about Jesus. She makes a big meal of Mary being allowed to talk about Jesus. Yeah. Yes, she sang the Magnificat. No one says she didn't. And no one says she wasn't allowed to. Like, women are allowed to speak about Jesus. That's a thing that's allowed to happen. And they're allowed to do ministry in the church. No one said they couldn't. Well, I'm sure there are some.
The
mainstream evangelicalism isn't busy saying that women are not allowed to talk about their Lord and
right,
Savior.
But I think.
But there's only one venue that matters.
That's
there's
what I'm
saying. There's only one venue that it matters.
What they mean by that is, unless we're ordained ministers in a pastoral role, then it doesn't count.
Right? Okay, and so here's another thing that I keep just rehashing the podcast I already did. I wish these people would read more widely, but I feel for Amy Peeler and all women alive today, because it is true that gender has been evacuated of all meaning, all substantial meaning, even spiritual, material, economic meaning. There's nothing attached to being male or being female. It's so flattened that it is incomprehensible to any woman today to discover that there's meaning inherent in something like being a mother, or even if you never gave birth, by virtue of being a person who could give birth, your personhood has substantial weight, material, economic, emotional, cultural weight, in a gendered way. And so Amy Peeler can't read the Bible or history, just like Kay Dumay couldn't and right. Beth Allison Barr, because they don't have anything left. If they can't do everything a man can do, they don't have any reason to exist for some reason.
Because the epochal millennial division between male and female that every culture has known and embraced in different ways,
but it's always there.
It has been just eviscerated.
Yeah, it's eviscerated
in our culture
by
technology, by feminism, by
Which, I mean, feminism was reaction to technology. So, again, right. You can have a lot of sympathy for the average feminist. Even, what's her name? Who did I blog about this morning? Chelsea Handler. You can even feel sorry for Chelsea Handler because she has nothing left.
She's
but her
very
big,
happy.
But her big bottle of wine.
She's and very her... happy. She's happy.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You better be quiet because she's so happy. So
we should pray for her. I did. I mean, I watched that. I watched her video responding to, just to take this off on a tangent here real quickly, but I watched her video responding to some other female bloggers saying Chelsea Handler is really insane. And I felt sorry for her. I felt like she was like really trying as hard as she could to tell everyone how happy she is. And she's not happy.
No, clearly
she seems very miserable. And I mean, we should pray for her to.
Yeah. Somebody should tell that lady about Jesus.
Have a husband and come to Jesus
and
believe.
I wouldn't recommend the husband part.
Not yet, but
like
not for a while anyway.
I just think that she has a Jesus shaped hole in her heart. Right. She's filling with wine.
And her hyperbaric chamber. She said, I can do anything I want and my hyperbaric chamber fixes it. So yeah,
okay, then.
That's her Jesus.
But that's where we are. And now, so I really feel for Amy Poehler because she, first of all, she's trying to articulate an Orthodox gospel. And she's Trinitarian. She believes that Jesus is God. She believes in the virgin birth and the resurrection of the dead. These are big things that ought not to be passed over. She should be congratulated for trying to be
in the Episcopal Church.
In the Episcopal Church. Yeah. And so, but she's saving Mary and Jesus and the God the Father from enemies that don't exist, even in our culture, even today. And we have to recover, the church has to go back and recover some meaning for women. Like, it can't just be this endless conversation about women's ordination and what women can or can't do. Like, a robust culture needs to be fashioned, I guess, out of nothing, out of the chaos, where women have meaningful personhood and work that is coded for elite status. Like, it has to, I guess this is the heartbreak. When I was a child, women in the church had greater status than the priest. The certain powerful women in the church possessed greater status, which, and you could tell kind of who they were and what kind of people they were based on how people related to them.
I told the story.
And that doesn't exist anymore.
Well, I told the story. It does. I mean,
it does.
I told the story. I mean, it does exist. It exists in every parish.
Yeah.
I mean, I told the story at the funeral for Joyce Coppola this last Saturday, one of our beloved, the triumvirate of women who were the foundation of our church for 15 years. She died during COVID, and we just buried her this last Saturday. And I said, you know, the first argument I had as a priest with one of my parishioners was with her. And it wasn't an argument, though. She was scolding me because I was putting something in the wrong place in the sacristy. And I never put that thing in that place again.
There are ways to.
Yeah, she had authority there that I don't have. So, I guess we said before, like in this podcast, about how the even though it's largely been eviscerated, there still are gendered roles in places. Like, so, like the Altar Guild in most churches tends to be a feminine place.
Yeah.
And the ushers tend to be a masculine place. And we all kind of understand that intuitively. We don't have to like assign that. That's just understood.
It's just so small. Like, it's all that's left.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it has to be, I don't know, in local communities, you have to be able to communicate. I don't know. I think there needs to be the possibility, besides just getting The only way for a woman to achieve importance in our culture is to get a PhD.
Lacey Jenkins. Right. If you don't follow Lacey Jenkins on Twitter, go follow Lacey Jenkins. It's a satirical account. But yeah,
I don't know. I think she's real.
But no, it's having either being a pastor or a PhD, I guess, is the only way a woman.
Which is actually also not true. Like, right. Most women find meaning in their lives, but, you know, as being mothers.
Yeah.
Or not being mothers, but doing, like, immensely important work in whatever world they're in and contributing to the life of the church and having meaningful relationships. But it's just somehow the people who are getting to set the narrative aren't those people.
Right.
So, and they keep writing books.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, women and men keep buying them. There's a glut of bad theology. Should we talk about the ACNA or no?
Oh yeah, sure. How long is this part?
How long have we gone?
Oh, we've gone for half an hour.
Okay, well, this won't take 15 minutes. Okay.
What would you like to say about the ACNA?
I feel like I've diagnosed the times in which we're living in the ACNA. And I think I know what's going on.
Okay.
So if you've not been paying attention to the ACNA, we've had in the last week the departure of one of the more important prominent churches in the most, I guess, liberal diocese in the ACNA, which is the Churches for the Sake of Others, C4SO. And this church was the Church of the Resurrection, or Res, Austin. And it was led by Sean McCain Tiras. And he has been, over the last few months, increasingly posting things on social media that were pro-LGBTQ. He's very woke, very social justice-y, which is, you know, a lot of people in that diocese are that way. But he was also becoming more and more quote-unquote affirming. And then he went silent for about a month. I mean, there was nothing on any of his social media outlets. And then the news broke that they were leaving the ACNA for the Episcopal Church. So, and that's the second official one.
Didn't from one of them the go same not diocese. To tech? Somebody just went on.
Right.
Their
so,
own.
Yeah, it's the second departure, or third departure, or second departure for tech. The first one is Matt Tebb, director of The Table in Indianapolis, another ACNA church that was in C4SO. They left for the Episcopal Church as well. But then there was another church from C4SO that went not to tech, but just, I think it went independent. But for the same reasons, they're more. So we have a growing number of churches and people within C4SO that are affirming, and they're going to the Episcopal Church, which they should do. And I've said in other podcasts that I respect Matt Tebb and Sean Tiras for deciding to leave rather than trying to change the ACNA. They're going to go where with integrity they can serve in another denomination. But I mean, all this. So I think what's happening is interesting. If you listen to what some of the more prominent progressive / liberal / woke people are saying in the ACNA, they're very frustrated. And they're frustrated because several things have happened. And from 2019 to 2022, it seemed like things were going their way. They were, this was during the COVID lockdowns. This was during the BLM riots. And there was kind of a peak of emphasis on all the things they're concerned with seem to be at the front and center of the conversation. And several people within the more quote unquote progressive wing of the ACNA began to be platformed, like in this, in New York Times and in other publications. They were given voices, and they're very woke voices. those who were given voice were very woke voices. So it seemed like at that time, I thought, oh man, this ACNA, this is terrible. But several things have happened that have halted that advance. And one is one of the first things was the bishops getting together and saying that Christians should not identify as gay. That was a huge thing for our College of Bishops to get together and say, okay, our identity is Christ, and whether you have homosexual desires or you feel like you're a man trapped in a woman's body, doesn't matter. You are a Christian, and so you identify as a Christian. You don't identify as a gay Christian or you're a Christian. You don't identify with your sin. That was a huge thing because that was at the height of the Revoice controversy.
Yeah, and I think at the time I probably didn't realize what a big deal. I mean, it was a big deal. It was pretty amazing, but I think I concentrated more on the blowback and how angry people were.
Yeah.
And less on like the actual statement and what it meant and why they were so angry. Like, it was actually pretty amazing that they were so angry.
Yeah.
And C4SO immediately put out a thing saying you didn't have to obey that.
Yeah, they were defiant, even though Todd Hunter, who's the bishop of C4SO, was in the room when the statement was passed
unanimously.
Right. So that was a big thing. And then the attempt that during that time, there was an anti-racism statement that was put out and published on the Anglican Compass website, which was at that time run by Greg Goebbels and Joshua P. Steele, who were the editors. And it was, apologizing for the racism in the ACNA, because even though the population of America has 11% African American, we only had like 1% African American priests. It was a confession of our racism, and based on just very spurious reasoning. And racism is a terrible sin if you are prejudicial or impartial toward or partial against a person because of the color of that person's skin, then that's a sin. You need to repent. But that's not going on in the ACNA. It's not happening. And if it is, I'd be happy to hear about it. But
I'm sure people are like, if it existed.
So anyway, because it was at the height of the BLM thing, a lot of people, just priests, even bishops, signed on to this statement. And so there was this movement that was then culminating in an attempt to get a bishop's statement put out. So there was a racial reconciliation committee formed, and I was a part of that committee. And we put together a statement which actually ended up condemning critical race theory and came out in a kind of orthodox position. And it was sent to the bishops and it was shut down. I think that was a huge discouragement to the people on the more woke side of things in the ACNA. That was those two things, that the College of Bishops statement on sexuality and that they couldn't get a woke racial statement. And those two things were huge. I think those were massive defeats. And then you have the Anglican Compass collapsing, essentially, which the Anglican Compass was the publishing arm of the woke and the ACNA. They were just putting things out right and left. And they were in the problem with that is that the Anglican Compass was also the kind of the entryway. Like if you were trying to figure out, hey, what's Anglicanism, and you Googled that, Anglican Compass would come up. So, they went through an editorial change, and there's a new editor at Anglican Compass who's orthodox and solid, and who took down the anti-racism statement. I mean, that was one of the first things he did. Peter Johnson, thank you for what you've done on the, if you're listening, in the Anglican Compass. You did an excellent job. So they lost their publishing wing, which is huge. Also, that was a big blow. And then came Kigali.
Right? Yeah, I think that was so amazing.
Kigali, like, because they were one of the underlying undercurrents of the kind of the woke in the 1800s. Oh, we can find a way to reconcile with the Episcopal Church, and you know, yeah, we have this, we have our convictions about sexuality. They have their convictions about sexuality, but we can all get along because those convictions are not essential to the gospel. And Kigali said, nope, it's essential to the gospel, which is what the Bible says.
Yeah.
And so we can't walk together. We can't reconcile until the Episcopal Church repents, or and also the Church of England repents. And so that was a huge blow, because our Archbishop was there, signed on to the statement.
Yeah. And he was front and center. Like,
yeah.
He, what I loved is that at the very end, everybody was in front of the GAFCON sign and was having their pictures taken for different provinces and groups, and he was in every picture. He was there, and he got into every single picture, and he was smiling, and he was really happy. And in our provincial meeting, when we were going over the statement, he and the other bishops were like, well, somebody was trying to say, quibble with one line, and he stepped up and said, we're not gonna turn over the 39 articles.
Yeah.
Like, they're quoting our formula.
Right. So, like, this is during our, like, so, and during the statement or the commitment had to go through vetting through all the different provincial meetings, right?
Yeah.
So in the ACNA provincial meeting, there was a line in the statement that said that the Bible is its own interpreter.
Yeah, that's what it was.
And there was a contingent from more woke mm-hmm. areas of the ACNA there, and they were objecting to everything basically, and none of their objections really mm-mm. got through, but they were really upset about this one. And then
Archbishop Foley Beach stood up and said, they're quoting the articles.
Yeah.
And so we're not going to not right. quote our own articles.
Right.
And I didn't know, like, at the time, did those people not know that that's in the articles? Like, you should.
They did. I think they knew just... it. They don't think it's authoritative.
Okay.
So, or they may not have, I don't know, but a lot of people don't think it's authoritative. So anyway, it's, that was so big. And so I think
they're discouraged.
They're discouraged. And I think they've tried to they try to cancel people. They try to cancel me. They want me to be disciplined. They want my bishop to say that I shouldn't say anything on social media. They've been trying to get that happen for like 2 or 3 years now, and it hasn't happened. And so they're discouraged about that. And so I think the more we talk, and don't be mean, just say basic orthodox things about sexuality.
I mean, what's so terrible is that even I can enter the fray. All you have to say is men can't become women.
Yeah, right. And they're embarrassed.
And like, and then
they're humiliated by that.
Hugely offensive to right. say, hey guys, Jesus is God. Jesus was a man. Men can't become women. And it's like,
You're hurting. You're hurting.
Yeah, you're hurting everybody.
You're causing harm. Your words are causing harm, man.
I know. So
I think we're at a place in the ACNA where if we just keep talking in a clear, strong, unafraid way, that ultimately we will win out, because I think the problem on the left, they really desire to be admired by the secular left and the secular affirming crowd, and their association with us is an impediment to that. So, I mean, I know that's why, the Rez Austin left. They were embarrassed by being associated with our
denomination,
which is constitutionally opposed to LGBT, the LGBT movement and abortion. So I think we're on the cusp of a pretty big victory here if we can just keep it up.
I totally agree. I feel for them. But again, though, in every denomination, pretty much, there's a liberal option. There's a woke option. The Presbyterians can join the PCUSA. The Methodists can go back to being
United Methodist.
Uh, Anglicans, there's two options in the United States. You can belong to the Episcopal Church, which was made for such a time as this.
Right.
Or the ACNA,
yep.
where, you know, amongst the low brow people who believe the 39 articles, who really think that Jesus was God, who think that love, the best way to love people is to tell them about Jesus and their sin and how they need Jesus. Like, that's how it's always been done. And it's not, I don't see why we should change it just because everything burned down in 2021 or whatever that was. Like, the Episcopal Church says they welcome everyone. It's not true, but
they say it.
So
it's in the sign. It's on the sign.
It's on the sign.
The Episcopal Church welcomes you.
Yeah. As long as you are not like low status.
Right. Yeah. Well, so anyway, I mean,
I agree. I think that
I'm
that's,
excited about the future now in a way that I wasn't in 2020, 2019. I was concerned. I mean, you know, also like another loss. I mean, another loss is the ACNA Facebook page, which has 7,000 followers, which used to be, or 9,000 now, I think, which used to be like a woke bastion. The woke promoters would go on there and just post article after article, post after post, and all of the mods were just like, or not all of them, but most of them were just complacent and compliant. And that I started
the unofficial page.
The unofficial page, which now has 5,000 something followers, in response to that. But now the official page is kind of quiet. It's like there's really nothing going on because when the ACNA got, when the ACNA officials recognized what was going on in their official page, they kind of shut it down. Because that was another big move that I think discouraged the woke.
Yeah.
And the increase of this unofficial page, I think, has really been another.
Well, one thing I think that should factor in is that I think people think that they want a uniformity of view. Like, that's one reason why wokeism is so discouraging to the woke themselves, because they do want to get rid of everybody who disagrees with them in general. They want this sort of, they have this kind of totalitarian view that you can't discuss what the word love means,
right?
Because it's already been decided. So you need to just be quiet and listen. So discussion always means if you disagree, you need to be quiet and listen. And
right.
I think, I don't know about this, but I feel like I've seen across a variety of pages that a lot of conservatives have just totally left. Like, they finally understand, oh, this isn't a discussion. I just need to say yes.
Right.
And so they left. And when that happened, there was no discussion. And that is actually really uninteresting. And so you're kind of, well, then there's nothing to talk about. And you didn't really win.
Yeah.
Like, everybody just went away. So you didn't get the glory of winning. It's just that they left, and
right.
So there's nothing there. And but also, you're
a great
really
example
sad.
Of that is Threads. Like,
yeah.
So the now Elon Musk bought Twitter, and he's made it a place where you can have free speech. You can actually say things, and he doesn't shut you down. So if you can say Leah Thomas is a man, and you can say there's no such thing as a trans man or a trans woman, and you don't get immediately banned, which is what happened before. So Threads is the Facebook or the Meta response to Twitter. And then when it first opened up, everyone so many of the woke just ran over there like, oh, this is heaven. This is great. It's just dying though. I mean, they're kind of quietly coming, you know, creeping back to Twitter. Or X or whatever it is now.
It's so dystopian. Yeah, I hate that he called it X.
Yeah.
It's really discouraging.
But I mean, it was like and it's an echo chamber. I mean, it's, you, the people who might say interesting things can't say them over there because of the restraints put on speech in and threads. So there's just a self-congratulatory, self-righteous kind of flavor
over there. Which is fine for a while, but then, like, yeah, then it's not that great.
Yeah, yeah. So it's what made Twitter good, and it's always made Twitter good when it was good, is you have the whole world there. You have conservatives, you have liberals, you have all kinds of people, and they can say whatever they want within reason. I mean, you can't put pornography on there, hopefully. Although some have tried, I've seen it. But you have this open market of speech, and that's always better. This is always better.
Well, yeah, I think it's,
yeah,
at least in this world, it's better,
right,
than the alternative.
Right.
I could get into a long discussion about whether or not it's really better, but
it's all about Christian nationalism.
Yeah. No, I think we should carry that discussion over to our paid option. If you'd like to follow us over to Demotivations with Anne and Matt on Mondays, you're welcome. We'll be over there for about 15 minutes talking about why the Anglican option for Christian nationalism is the best option and what's wrong with all the people who are talking about it without knowing how great it would be to be Anglican and have a king. I'm pretty sure we've talked about this before, but we're going to do it again.
We're doing it differently this time.
We're doing it different because we're so creative. So thank you for listening, and we will be back next week.